down there. Nice scenic tour of Como neighborhood. And
we have overviews on the agenda today, just for your information. Next week on Monday, we'll be doing confirmations. We doing on Wednesday, anything exciting? Not yet. We don't know what we're doing yet on Wednesday. So today we're doing overviews, and we'd like to welcome Carolyn Parnell, who I ran into in the tunnel, and any staff people you want to have join you for overview of the Office of Enterprise Technology. Before we get started with that, I just wanted to welcome Melissa Wicklund to the committee. You missed all of our introductions, but you probably will get to know our colleagues.
Yes,
but thank you for, we lost Barb Goodwin, but we gained Melissa.
Yeah,
so
I'm
thanks
glad to be
for
here.
Joining us.
Yeah, thank you.
Do you want to say a little bit about your district?
Well, I represent District 50. It's a large portion of Bloomington and then a large part of Richfield. So.
She took Bloomington from me.
Yes. That's
yeah. Okay. I was thinking of a smart comment, and I decided not to make it.
Oh, come on.
A little self-censor there.
You're just wondering whether we're televised or not, right?
Yeah. Okay, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name, for the record, is Carolyn Parnell. I am the Commissioner of the Office of Enterprise Technology, which we now call Minute Services. I'm also the state CIO. And I'm here to give you an overview of Minute Services, and of course that can't be done without...
Commissioner, does that stand for anything, Minute Services?
It stands for Minnesota IT Services,
oh.
Which we have shortened to Minute.
Okay. Chrissy.
We wanted something that really reflected Minnesota, and there were a lot of OET offices around the country, and we think that Minute Service best captured the
well, and it reflects identity. When something's wrong with your technology, you want it fixed in a minute.
That's right.
There
That's
you
right.
go.
So in order for me to give an overview of Minute Services, I also need to sort of give you a catch-up on where we are with IT consolidation. If you recall, in the 2011 legislature, you handed us a huge, huge task of consolidating all of IT in the state of Minnesota. So we actually had to begin with 70 different agencies and boards, and they all had different ways of defining IT. They all had different ways of delivering IT. And we were charged with consolidating all of those different approaches to IT into one singular approach for the state. I believe that the intention of the legislature and of the governor was to have one place to go to find out what's happening in the world of IT in the state of Minnesota. And this certainly does satisfy that requirement. So we have been working on the requirements of the legislation. Again, it was full consolidation for all of the executive branch.
Commissioner, did any of this start at all under your predecessor? That was Gopal?
Gopal Khanna. You know, there had been a lot of conversation about IT consolidation, but nothing had really been started. When I came on board, there was legislation on the table, so there had been a good deal of interest in it, and I have to give credit to the legislative authors who really worked to come up with language that made this very doable.
And it was so Representative Khan in the House, and who was the Senate author?
It was Keith Downey and Terry Bonoff, and Ann Rest was involved, and Phyllis Khan.
Okay.
So we were required to transfer authority of all IT assets, all IT people, applications, projects, everything having to do with IT by October 1st of 2011. That gave us 10 weeks to come up with an approach to IT consolidation. We had no money allocated for this effort. although we were allowed to find savings and plow those savings back into IT consolidation efforts. We did not have any particular demands in the legislative language other than to consolidate IT. So I have promised efficiencies, but we did not have any mandate to have layoffs or to outsource any services, to make any management changes, et cetera. And we were required to have specific service level agreements signed with every agency by the end of June 30th, 2012. And we were required to set up a technology advisory committee to advise the state CIO, not on IT consolidation, but on the delivery of IT to the state going forward.
And you survived all of this?
We have survived so far. And actually, we have completed all of those tasks. Now, the first thing we did was sit down and come up with a plan. We knew that people were very disconcerted about this legislation. The business owners were, I think, very concerned about losing control. Employees did not have any idea of what it meant for them, and they were, you know, wondering where they showed up for work on October 3rd. But we started very quickly, I think the day after the legislation was signed, to communicate with employees, sort of reduce their angst, and tell them that we would not plow ahead quickly without consulting with them, without picking their brains on how we should go about doing this. And we also promised the business and agencies that we would consult with them going forward. So you can see where we are right now. But in order to get to this point, we sort of defined our approach going forward. We did not want to turn people's lives upside down. So our first approach was to actually centralize IT within agencies. That wasn't the case for all agencies. And for example, the Department of Transportation had a CIO. It's a huge, huge organization, but not all of the IT was under the purview of that CIO. So we did centralize, and we had a whole challenge just in identifying who was an IT employee in scope, who was out of scope. There were employees who had been classified as IT employees who were not doing IT work, and vice versa. But we were able to pull together all of the IT in each agency and put them under under the CIO. Now, the other thing was that we had basically 70 different ways of defining IT. So one of the other first things that we had to do was come up with what we called an IT reference model, which was a way for everybody to describe the delivery of IT in the same language. It was an expectation that all agencies would have similar language and similar functions. And it was a way for us to define whether or not an agency was able to fulfill all those basic requirements of IT delivery. So, for example, one of the functions in the IT reference model was security. And there were agencies who did not have a security function. Well, we were able to identify that. And we didn't have to go out and hire someone for security. We could borrow that expertise from another agency now that we could cross those agency boundaries. So we did elevate the role of the CIOs. We wanted people to pull them into the strategizing of the business needs for an agency. And we really relied on the CIOs for things like defining what was in scope, what employees were in scope, et cetera. At the same time, we recognized that there were a lot of boards and smaller entities that did not have CIOs in place. And we were able to sort of double up and have, for example, a number of smaller boards report to the CIO for administration. So we think we were pretty judicious in how we organized that role of the CIO. We also wanted to do some benchmarking with the private sector. We are now an organization that is equal in size with some of the larger corporations in the state, and we know that some of the private sector had already been down this path to some extent, so we did consult with them. We did that kind of research. We did not have a standard template for a service level agreement with each agency. We had really hoped to just copy something that someone had, but we had to start from scratch and define that as well. In the end, I believe we had altogether about 9,000 pages in all of the service level agreements when you combine them for all agencies. It was a really huge effort. But for the first time, we can define for each agency what IT they get, who delivers it, where it's delivered, and how much it costs. That was a really, really important inventory of IT assets for the state. And then we recognize that, you know, the IT employees in the state are highly skilled. We have applications that aren't common in the world outside of state government. So we needed to recognize and understand that that expertise needed to be recognized and supported and retained for the most part. And then we did not want to give everybody the message that we knew exactly what our end state was going to be and we were just going to sort of plow our way to that end state. We were pretty careful about being collaborative and getting a real sense from employees and from agencies on how we should go about consolidation. This is just a sort of picture of our projects and deliverables for the first three phases. Each of these lanes had to do with the function, and each of those boxes are sort of major project with all kinds of documentation and project plans behind them. But it was a way to lay out our approach, to communicate our approach, and to get people and employees involved in what we were doing and a part of what we were doing.
Yes, Senator.
Are you taking questions now, or you want to wait till after the presentation?
Oh, we can take them now.
Okay. I have a question.
Go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Parnell, the service level agreements now, are they all in place for all of the different agencies that you were working with?
Commissioner Parnell.
Madam Chair, Senator, yes, we have one for each agency and each board. I think there were over 70, almost maybe 90 altogether. That first service level agreement with each agency is something that we consider a baseline for the budget for that agency. It was an as-is picture of all of the IT that we were delivering to them. It is, however, something we consider to be a living document. We try to review them on a quarterly basis, and when it comes to budgeting time, any diversion from that service level baseline cost of IT is something that, whether it goes up or down, it is a negotiated change with the agency. It was the only way we felt we could continue to deliver the IT that people had been accustomed to, be really open and transparent about what the costs were, but manage those service level agreements going forward.
Thank you.
Senator Anderson?
Thank you.
Okay, done? All right, proceed.
So I won't go through this slide either, but I believe you have a copy. This was our intent on how we wanted to have each of these areas sort of defined by the end of the year. We were able to also accomplish all of these outcomes as we had defined them from the beginning. The third phase was really coming up with a master plan, a strategic plan, and a governance structure. The master plan is the result of listening sessions that we had with agency business leaders. And if you had been in those listening sessions, you could actually trace the comments made to the actual document that we ended up with. It was a reflection of what business wanted us to consider in terms of IT consolidation, what we needed to think of as drivers as we change the way we deliver IT in the state. And they were very, very involved in that conversation. The strategic plan, and I believe you have copies of these in your files, the strategic plan was a result of listening sessions with IT employees. We are really, in essence, defining and building a new organization with a new culture, and we really need to do that to retain and attract the brightest and the best. And this strategic plan is really defined as what we're going to be as an organization. What's our vision? What are our values? What's our mission, et cetera. So again, you can trace what was said in those meetings with what ideas employees came up with, and we held them all over the state to the actual outcome in that document. And then, of course, IT governance is something that I believe in a great deal. We cannot make decisions in isolation. And we have a pretty robust IT governance framework set up. This is a very busy slide, but I'll just give you one example. These different functions are functions that we want to be able to engage not only employees but the business of agencies in. So, for example, one of the committees has to do with security. So our governance structure has co-chairs of each of these committees. So the co-chair for security is generally the person in the agency that sort of owns that issue. So for security, it's the chief information security officer. And that's co-chaired by a CIO from the agency. And in this case, that's Lieutenant Colonel Stephanie Horvath, who's the CIO for military affairs. Those committees are also staffed by business owners and people who we have recruited because they either have an interest in security or we think they should, and also subject matter experts who are IT employees in the state. So that brings us up to the Minute Organization as we now know it. We did change the name. Not legally, but we're sort of OET doing business as Minute Services. And that was largely a need to really define a new organization. If we're going to be building a new culture for IT in the state, then we wanted a new identity and a new name to go along with that. We have approximately 2,055 employees, 22 agency-based offices, and up to now, we have kept IT employees in their agencies, recognizing that there's often going to be a kind of tension where they are, for example, sitting in MMB, but they're a part of Minute Services. And we should just sort of bring that tension out in the open and say we understand that you know, you don't have to forsake the agency that you're in, but you really are a part of the new IT organization in the state. And I think that has worked pretty well. I was in a meeting somewhere with employees, and an employee just said, you know, I consider myself a dual citizen. And I thought, mm-hmm. Yeah, that probably works. so we really respect the cultures of the agencies where these employees sit. We know that they understand the business needs of agencies very well. And that agencies have really, really, truly unique needs. DOT builds roads, which is very different from housing prisoners, which is very different from, handing out hunting and fishing permits. So we really respect those unique needs.
Senator Scalzi.
Thank you, Ms. Chair. Commissioner, and this is just a huge undertaking, and it's just really wonderful at this point to see how far you've come. I've followed this for quite some time. I was elected in 2004, and we've watched this coming through. And originally, we were told that there were something like 17 or 18 computer centers, and what we were going to end up with was fewer and fewer employees. I know there was some consternation on the part of the employees that they may lose their job. The thought at that time was with attrition, we would bring the number down. So I'm kind of curious now when we see 22 agency-based offices, I'm wondering if we have really come down in size or have we increased in size? And I'm wondering how many employees were in, say, in 2008 versus the 2,055 employees that we have now.
Commissioner Parnell.
Madam Chair, Senator, I think you're referring to data centers and last I heard, we had a count of about 36 data centers in the state, not all of them up to snuff when it comes to housing some of the mission-critical applications that we have. We have now contracted for real estate for a data center, so we will be, as part of consolidation, consolidating all of those data centers in the state. When it comes to IT employees, you know, I have had a consistent message for employees that layoffs and outsourcing are not part of our IT strategy, and there's a couple reasons for that. One is that we can't determine that ahead of time, and so we didn't have a preconceived notion about layoffs. But a larger reason is that when we look at just the IT employees in the state, up to 30% are eligible for retirement in the next 2 or 3 years. Mm-hmm. That's huge. Mm-hmm. So our bigger job is to manage that brain drain, as I call it, and to make sure that we can continue to offer the services that we need to serve to offer based on that retirement factor. And I think that's true all over the state, but again, there are some very specializations in IT that are difficult to replace, which is one of the motivations for really defining a culture that's very attractive to the employees that we are going to need to replace the people are leaving. Will that be on a one-for-one basis? Not at all. But we will have a more reasoned approach to how we're going to take care of that retirement factor.
Senator Scalzi.
Thank you, Jen. Then as a follow-up, I think the question I had asked was, how many employees did we have in the year 2008 versus the 2,055 employees that we have in 2013?
Commissioner Parnell.
Madam Chair, Senator, I don't know that number, but I can find out. I can tell you that, you know, there are multiple retirements every week, mm-hmm. even now. But I do not know that count right
Maybe
now.
Maybe you can get that to us. Yeah. And, Ms. Chair, another question regarding this now, regarding the number of data centers that we have had, and this was my question all along, is when you consolidate, then where do they go? And now it sounds as though there's real estate being considered. Do you know where that is? And are we going to be building a new building just for IT, whereas before they were housed in various places within the state?
Commissioner Parnell.
Madam Chair, Senator, no, we are not building a new building. We are leasing real estate. You know, I can say there are 36 data centers. In reality, some of those data centers are probably pretty close to broom closets. And we have systems in them that are not in an appropriate environment, either for security or for redundancy. It is a new site that is for equipment only. So we are not outsourcing the support of all of those applications. It's just actually the hardware and the servers the people who support those applications will stay where they are and just support them remotely. We did not buy a building. It's, in my opinion, a very remedial move. It should have been done 5 or 6 or 7 years ago. We have a lot of systems in substandard space, and this is a move to correct that.
Senator Scalzi.
Sorry, but no, I've worked on this for a long time, and this is kind of interesting. So you're leasing, which is, I mean, somebody's building a building or providing a building. So you're leasing in a large building. How many square feet are we consolidating down to, whereas we're now in the various departments physically?
Commissioner.
Madam Chair, Senator, I believe we're starting out contracting for 2,000 square feet. Part of data center consolidation has to do with what's called virtualization. And that means that you can have fewer and fewer servers supporting more and more applications. So I don't know. I can find out. I know there have been studies on it. The difference in square feet as it is now in a sort of scattered way compared to what we're contracting for, I can get that number as well.
Commissioner, is the Senate and House IT part of the consolidation?
Madam Chair, no, it only applies to the executive branch.
Okay, why don't you, any more questions right now? Oh, Senator Torres-Ray.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair and Commissioner, I have, I am really congratulations, Commissioner. This was an amazing exercise that you embarked in and really produced amazing results. So I'm very impressed, especially, you know, I have been working before I came to the Senate. I work with the state. I share this with you, with Health and Human Services, for many years, and I know the complexity of bringing these people together and training and do all of these work. So it's amazing that you've been able to make so much progress in such a short period of time. I am, however, interested in kind of the application of this. And I'm curious about one aspect of the application that I would like to be able to analyze. The state has, through time, cut a lot of resources into a specific state agencies. Health and Human Services, education are a couple of examples. A lot of the positions that for, you know, circumstances like retirement or whatever circumstance take an employee away from the job, that job usually gets eliminated. And more and more, particularly in Health and Human Services, a lot of the salaries of individuals are being paid by federal resources, combination of federal and state. A lot of state employees who are being paid by federal, with federal dollars, are doing state work. And so there is a, I'm quite concerned about this evolution as being kind of a 10-year that I have observed very closely in terms of the cuts that have been kind of implemented, how positions are not being replaced, how those jobs are being assigned to other people, how these jobs are being paid with federal dollars, how these jobs are being done by the counties. So my experience is only in Health and Human Services, but I presume that applies to other. Is that application available to us? Can we do an analysis of that in the current system across agencies, or that's not a possibility?
Commissioner Parnell.
Madam Chair, Senator, my senator, I might add.
Thank you.
I'm not privy to a study that's been done to that effect. I can only speak to the IT employees. And I also can't personally speak to what occurred before I was here. But I can tell you that we're very aware of the federal funding, and you know, part of my message is we do not have as part of our strategy any layoffs or any outsourcing. But, you know, if there's federal funding that's cut, I don't have control over that. And so I think that's maybe a concern. Presumably, though, if that federal funding is cut for programs, then that program kind of goes away. But for me, the larger answer to that question is, for the first time, we can reach across agency boundaries and fulfill the IT needs from a perspective of consolidation. So we may, through attrition or through some kind of program change, lose an IT employee, but it's no longer just that one DHS agency issue. We can sort of step up to the plate and continue to deliver those IT needs from a deeper bench at this point. I'm not sure that answered your questions, but.
Madam Chair, Commissioner, I think that my question is more with related to kind of how we can utilize the system that is connected across agencies to kind of understand what is happening in terms of employment patterns. So it's not related to your division in particular, but the information that is available through your system to kind of be able to see patterns. I don't know if that is, you know, a possibility that we could now have more access to across agencies, you know, kind of gathering of information through the system that is now in place.
Commissioner.
Madam Chair, Senator, yes, that's very true for IT employees. We know, as I said, exactly who's delivering what and where. We can roll up, for example, all the agencies working in a function like security or working in a function like a service desk, and you know, sort of be able to accumulate the information about those roles. Going beyond the IT employee, I can't speak to that. I think that's something that MMB probably tracks.
Okay, why don't you proceed?
Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Madam Chair. So one of the things we've learned is that there are 2,000-plus distinct applications in the state, and a sort of factoid around that is about 500 of those applications are mission-critical enough that if they're down for more than 24 hours, there's significant risk to either public safety or public welfare. So that is something that we are very conscious of. And as a result of that gathering of information about IT and putting together those service level agreements, we now have a combined annual budget of $451 million. That's operational only. That is not project dollars, and I'll get into that in a little bit. So this is in the next biennial, 2014-15, we have an operational budget of $902 million. And you can see that I think it's only 19% of that that comes from the general fund. The rest of it comes from federal fund or special revenue funds. This current year, this current biennium, we have 61 projects in process, 17 different agencies. This includes MNLARS, which is the redo of the motor vehicle system, and, of course, the health exchange. I have not updated this information as a result of the governor's budget yesterday. The new projects have a total of $92.4 million, I believe, and I think they're closer to 20 different projects. And just to give you a sort of reality check of where our budget is with the rest of the world, we have some comparisons here, some benchmarks with all industries, with a sort of consortium of government education and nonprofit, and from the North American public sector. And you can see that we are not at all overspending IT in the state. And I think IT consolidation is not, to me, something that means we're going to spend less IT money necessarily, but it certainly means that we're going to spend it smarter. And one of the reasons I say that is when you look at some of the legacy systems around the state, you find some very, very old systems. DHS has systems that are 30 going on 40 years old, and you know, they're just too old to sustain. They have been underfunded. We have underinvested in those systems, and they do need to be replaced. We have also found some have and have not agencies. You know, some of the agencies that are well funded with federal funds can, you know, put a lot of infrastructure in and have all of the latest IT things that they need. Other agencies have been sort of sorely neglected. So we are not mature enough as an organization to be able to find the cash savings that we can reinvest in those systems. We expect to get to that point in 2 or 3 years, but as a result, you will hear some agencies who ask for some investment in their infrastructure. Now, on the other side of that is we have already found savings, or I should actually more appropriately call it cost avoidance, by virtue of IT consolidation. We have been able to leverage some infrastructure purchases from one agency with another. We have been able to consolidate some contracts with vendors that had been scattered around the agencies. And when we pull them all together and ask for one contract with volume discounts, we're able to get that. So we expect to continue that approach. But there definitely are some agencies, and particularly some of the smaller boards, that have some real IT needs that are quite immediate. So this sort of brings us up to where we are right now. So we had spent an entire year very carefully planning and communicating how we wanted to go about consolidating IT. We defined IT for everybody who needed to have the same definition. We put it together service level agreements. We had a huge, huge effort just to get all IT employees in the state HR system to reflect that they were in minute services. And now we are sort of setting about the tactical plan, which is, as I've told employees, where the rubber hits the road. This is where we really find the efficiencies that we know we can find through IT consolidation. I believe that in the end we'll end up with four broad categories of service. The first is what this tactical plan relates to, and that's sort of the core services that every agency has in common. Email is a good example. We have recently gone through a migration of a very distributed email service to an enterprise-level email service. There was one agency that had, I believe, 28 separate and different servers handling their email. Well, each one of those servers requires software upgrades, software patches, lifecycle replacement of servers, etc. And by going down the path of enterprise email, we were able to save that particular agency a good deal of money. They're paying half what they were paying for email. On the other hand, there were some agencies that had email that was not up to appropriate or proper email standards. They didn't have security. They didn't have backups, etc. They may have paid a little bit more. But one of my challenges and responsibilities, I believe, through IT consolidation is to try to educate people about IT from the enterprise perspective as opposed to the agency perspective. I think it's my job to understand that agency perspective, which in some instances can be quite different from the enterprise perspective, but I have to try to get people to understand that there is an enterprise perspective. The second sort of category of services I think we'll end up with are those services that can be shared. So, for example, if an agency needs a case management system software, right now there are about 19 different solutions for that in the state. I think that we can, as we go down this road of consolidation, look for savings in that area and look for the opportunities to share those kinds of applications. It might mean that they have to change their business process, but that's a good deal of duplication that I don't think that we need. The third broad category is what's truly unique to an agency, and I mentioned this before, and we really truly respect those unique needs, and they can't be met from a consolidated perspective. And then the fourth, and I only mention this because it's already in place, the fourth is outsourced services. Again, we're not going down that path as part of our strategy, but we do already have outsourced services. For example, we have a network all over the state that is outsourced to a wide variety of telcos around the state. We provide services to all of MNSCU and all of their institutions, and we will continue to do that. So the tactical plan, though, is to deal with that set of core services like email and network and the data center. We have a pretty aggressive plan that will take us a good way down the road for the next 2 years. And we are really literally redesigning those services from the ground up. So in a consolidation like this, it would be easy for the central, the old OET organization, who had been accustomed to providing services across all agencies, even though they were limited, to just say, well, we'll continue to do that and just give you what you need. But we recognize, again, that there are a good deal of very smart IT employees who, you know, live and breathe IT, quite frankly, and we wanted to really take advantage of their very fine thinking. So our tactical plan consists of 17 to 18 different projects that have a course of action from actual design to implementation of the new service. That's staffed by employees, and they are very engaged. The first project that we put out there that we had a call for participants, I think we needed 6 to 8 people, and we got 80 employees with that specialization who were interested in stepping up to the plate and contributing to this effort. So I consider that a success. So, you know, the IT world, you've probably heard it or seen it everywhere. The way to kind of define it now is deliver it through the cloud. Well, to me, that's kind of a marketing term, but it's useful. So we have sort of defined this approach toward delivering these core services as putting those services in the cloud. So the email project that I spoke to, moving toward an enterprise solution for email, was putting that email in the cloud. So that's basically what we're doing. What our intent is, by pulling together this first tactical plan over the next 2 years, is to really free up agencies to be looking for the new things that they need to be looking for to meet their needs down the road. If we can sort of take care of those core services, then the CIO from the Department of Human Services does not have to take his iPhone or his BlackBerry and constantly check the status of email or be on call for email. He's now freed up to sort of look around and say, you know, wow, how can I better meet the needs of IT for DHS, and how can I be aware of what's going on in the rest of the state that I can then partner with another CIO on. We have some operational support behind that. That is a sort of redefinition of our new size, I think, and our new responsibilities. We, again, are literally taking employees from agencies and putting them together with people from Minute Central who have also stepped up to the plate and offered to help redesign these systems. And we're very, very conscious of what this means to employees who aren't doing something that is truly unique to an agency. This is just a picture of the actual project plan that we have for this tactical plan. You can sort of look at that at your leisure, but it really defines what we expect to accomplish in the next 2 years. Some of these projects are really quite aggressive and quite large. So we've kind of mapped them out piecemeal. Not everything will be completed in the next 2 years, but we will have made significant progress. One of the things we've been very clear about is that we are not in the business of IT consolidation. We really aren't. We are in the business of providing IT to meet the business needs of the state. But at the same time, we also have to do IT consolidation. So we have a dual track. So we have thrown these dates out, and we have every intention of making progress on a regular basis. But, you know, then things like the health exchange comes along and throws some things in the works. So I'm almost finished, but I think it's important to talk about our approach towards employees. Again, we've had a great deal of respect for the skill set that we have in place. We know that we will have to retrain some employees, but, you know, quite frankly, in the IT world, we're always all about change. This is maybe a little more imposed than usual, but any of us who have been in IT as a career, that's all we deal with is change and retraining and, you know, pulling out old systems and putting in new systems. This is just coming from a different place and much more I think, coordinated across the state than it has been before. And again, we really focus a good deal on communication, not only to employees, but tailored messages to business owners, to CFOs, to deputy commissioners, so that everybody is in the know pretty much exactly what we're doing. And who, in the end, benefits from IT consolidation? These are sort of the three things that we try to balance as we go down this path. You know, one is our agency customers. We are very clear about needing to meet their needs. We're very clear about really, truly valuing our employees. And I have to tell you, I came to the state. I really didn't know anybody. I didn't have a good sense, but I have been really, really impressed by the caliber and the expertise of state employees, and probably more than anything, their commitment to public service. You know, we are in a pretty competitive world of IT in the state of Minnesota. It's getting even better. But there are people whose motivation is public service, and I think that's something to be really valued. And then our stakeholders. One of the things I sort of consistently think about is that, you know, we all kind of have the same constituents, which are the citizens of Minnesota. And through IT consolidation, I kind of try to keep my focus on that's who we really want to benefit in the end, is Minnesota citizens. And so we all have that in common. We all have different kind of paths to doing that, but we do think that the citizens of Minnesota really do benefit from IT consolidation.
Thank you very much. Are there any questions from the committee members? Thank you. With no questions, we will welcome you back then on Monday for your confirmation hearing, and obviously you don't have to repeat this presentation.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Next, we have an overview of the Board of Arts by Sue Jentz and Ellen McNinnis.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to be here today. My name is Ellen McGinnis, and I am chair of the Minnesota State Arts Board. I'm not able to be here next week for the confirmation appointments, so I wanted to have a chance to introduce myself.
Good.
And tell you how honored I am to serve on the board. I was first appointed to the board in 2004 by Governor Pawlenty. I was reappointed for my second term by Governor Pawlenty in 2008 and appointed to my third term by Governor Dayton in 2012. And this is my second year as serving as the chair of the State Arts Board. You might be interested in knowing that I'm a University of Minnesota graduate with a degree in political science and a minor in English literature. And so this appointment and serving in this capacity allows me to take two things that I really love and put them together. And I feel incredibly fortunate to be able to do that in my life. In a minute, I'm going to hand it off to our executive director, Sue Jentz, to give you an overview of the agency and our programs. But I want to just point out three things for you that I think are really important for you to understand about the Arts Board. First, we have an effective system. The board works very closely with 11 regional arts councils across the state of Minnesota, and together we form a very strong and effective statewide system. We are citizen-driven. Hundreds of Minnesotans help us determine how the Arts Board and the regional arts councils will invest state funds each year. We use our citizen advisory committees to review grant applications and to make recommendations to the board. Impact. Our programs and services reach all 87 counties in the state of Minnesota. Public funding represents a small portion of the overall budgets of these arts organizations and programs in the state, but they are a key investment that they leverage many times over. And lastly, I will add before I hand it over to our executive director, Ms. Jentz, is that we are nationally recognized for our work, and the State Arts Board is an agency you can be incredibly proud of. Even today, I received a call from a colleague in Wisconsin from their State Arts Board asking about our programs, our services, and how we function. So we are looked to by others as a model. So with that, unless there are questions, I will turn it over to our executive director.
Ms. McInnis, since you can't be here on Monday, could you tell us a little bit about yourself and your background?
Yeah, well, in addition to being the U of M grad and political science grad, in my day job, I do government relations and community liaison work for Wells Fargo. I've been doing that for 25 years. I used to cover the state legislature for them a number of years ago, but now have focused my attention on local government liaison work. So in my day job, I have the task of interfacing with local governments on fund issues like foreclosures and REO, real estate owned property disposition, and also important community development initiatives like, for example, the presence that we've made, Wells Fargo has made in the Phillips neighborhood with the mortgage campus there. Mm-hmm. In addition to that, personally, I had a very moving experience with the arts, and I think it's profoundly affected me ever since I was 10 or 11 years old. I have a brother who is disabled, and I went to see Of Mice and Men at the Guthrie Theater, and Peter Michael Goetz was starring in that particular performance. And I don't think I really understood my brother's situation or profound grief until I saw that performance. It was really moving. And then my poor parents, took me to guitar lessons and piano lessons, all kinds of things to expose me to the arts. None of them took in terms of my own skill set. But the love and the passion is deeply there, and it's a part of my life, and it's allowed me to, I think, be smarter, a better person, a better employee, a better citizen of Minnesota. So thank you for the opportunity.
Thank you. Any questions from the members of the committee? All right. Well, we'll look forward to your confirmation and without you being there.
I'm crossing my fingers.
All right. Okay. And Director Gens.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Sue Gens. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota State Arts Board. I've been in that position for 4 years, but I've been with the agency for 11 years. So it's my pleasure to give you a very brief overview of our agency. I won't be giving you quite the detail that Commissioner Parnell gave you. It'll be more of a summary. And so if you have questions at the end or if there's materials or information we can get you after the hearing, we'll be happy to do that. We are considered a non-cabinet level executive branch board. Our roles, our responsibilities, our authority is spelled out in Minnesota statutes, Chapter 129D. It's a very brief section of the overall state statutes. This, in a nutshell, is what we are meant to do. We stimulate and encourage the creation, performance, and appreciation of the arts in the state. Chair McGinnis mentioned that we are seen as a national model. Minnesota has been a leader in the arts for a very long time. We were one of the very first states to create an agency within state government to support the arts. We did that in 1903. We were one of the first states to create a system where we have a state agency and also regional councils, and we did that in 1977. And we obviously were the first state, and so far the only state, that has guaranteed funding for arts and cultural heritage in its state constitution. So we are recognized as a leader. And you might wonder, why? Why a state agency for the arts? Why should we be doing these things? It's because Minnesotans care about the arts. I'm going to give you three quick statistics that come from the Minnesota State Survey, which is something the University of Minnesota does each year. 3/4 of Minnesotans participate in some sort of arts activity every year. 95% of Minnesotans believe that the arts are vital to education. 90% of Minnesotans believe that creative activities and the arts make this a place that they want to live and work. So first of all of our constituents think that the arts are important. Secondly, the arts are not something that you make contributions to or you give as a charitable contribution only. They actually are an investment. And I've listed on this slide some of the ways that the arts give back to their communities and to the state. And I won't go through all of them. You have the handout. But a couple that I would highlight is in Greater Minnesota, in Lower Town, where our office is, in Northeast Minneapolis, we see what the arts can do to revitalizing neighborhoods and communities. We see ways that arts performances, arts traditions can build a bridge between different cultures. One of the things that we think is really important is more and more statistics show that CEOs and business owners are saying creativity is the most important skill they look for in new workers. And so being involved in the arts and kind of exercising those creative skills is great training for the workforce of the future. I mentioned arts education. There's quite a bit of research that shows that children who have a chance to study the arts do better in other subjects. It does carry over. And we think that the arts help bring visibility to the state of Minnesota, the way Ms. McGinnis mentioned. It's also an important industry. Collectively, the nonprofit arts industry, the nonprofit arts organizations, cultural organizations, and the artists who live here and do their work here contribute about $1 billion of economic activity. I would single out those individual artists, most of whom are individual sole proprietors doing business on their own, buying services. And so collectively, we think that we help give back to the state and contribute in a variety of ways. Sharing with you our vision, we believe that Minnesotans, all Minnesotans, no matter who they are, should have the opportunity to participate in the arts, and that means different things to different people. For some people, it's maybe attending a concert or a play. For others, it might be taking a class or painting or writing poetry in their spare time. For others, if you're a small business owner in greater Minnesota, the way you might participate and benefit from the arts is that the night that there's a concert or a play going on, your restaurant might be more busy. Or if you're a hotel owner, you might have more business that comes in because of it. So we see many ways that Minnesotans can benefit from the arts. I'm sharing with you, I was so thrilled when the legacy amendment was passed. Our board and the regional arts councils together tried to imagine what 25 years from now might look like as a result of the new investments. Some of those we might manage, but others will as well. And we gave ourselves some very big goals, and I've shared those with you. The first one is kind of the uber goal, if you will, and the others add into it. We believe that the arts are essential in a vibrant society. And the other things that are below it help add to that. We want the arts to be more connected to community life. We want Minnesotans to understand, as Ms. McGinnis pointed out in her example, understand the impact that they can have. We see people of all ages and abilities and ethnicities participating. We want to be strong stewards of those public resources that we're responsible for, and we want the arts to thrive in Minnesota. So that's a little bit of why. We do what we do. I wanted to talk just briefly about this, how we are structured. This, I think, is a community chorus, and I think that was Staples, Minnesota. We do have a state board. Ms. McGinnis is one of our 11 members appointed by the governor, and then obviously with your consent and approval, they will be confirmed to be regular members of our board. They serve 4-year terms, and they represent all 8 congressional districts with 3 members serving at large. We are very citizen-driven. We use 250 to 300 volunteers a year just at the Arts Board to help us review grant applications and make recommendations. We have a panel going on as we speak back in our office. And we have a professional staff of 18 FTEs. In the statute, we are directed to be the fiscal agent for 11 regional arts councils. And you see the maps, those of you who were familiar with the Regional Development Commission boundaries of the 1970s, that's where these boundaries come from. The idea was, like the federal government and the state governments, there are different things that are done at different levels. Here in Minnesota, we have a state arts agency that does certain things, and then we have local decision-making at the regional council level. We make block grants to those regional councils, and they are responsible for designing programs and services that are directly tailored to their part of the state. So you wouldn't expect to see the same things happening in Region 3 that you see in Region 6 or in Region 8. For the Arts Board, our programs are the same no matter where you are in the state, but the regional arts councils can be a little bit more personalized. Okay, a few of our key activities. For both the Arts Board and the Regional Arts Councils, our primary activity is grant making. We provide financial assistance to really a dizzying range of individuals, organizations, communities, nonprofits, just a whole variety of different kinds of programs and activities. We have 11 grant programs at the Arts Board. Each of the Regional Arts Councils has somewhere between 5 and 10, so collectively there might be 100 different grant programs that are available across the state of Minnesota, doing different things, serving different kinds of potential grantees. But here are some common characteristics that we see in the grant programs. Obviously, connecting Minnesotans to the arts is the first thing we all do. We try to build the capacity of nonprofit organizations, make them stronger and healthier. We do things to invest in the careers of individual artists and in their artistic abilities. We enhance what's available in the schools for arts education. We don't replace that. The state of Minnesota has graduation arts requirements and arts standards that are the responsibility of each school district, but we can do things to help go over and above that. And obviously, wherever those activities happen, there is that economic, that community benefit. We also provide different kinds of services, and I am being very, very broad. Technical assistance is common across the Arts Board in all of the regions. We get dozens of calls in our office every week. Somebody has a project, somebody has an idea, somebody has a problem, somebody has a particular situation that they need some help with, and our staff and I will try to help them problem solve if we can, or give them resources or referrals if we can. We try to build the capacity of the nonprofit sector. And so professional development might be workshops in financial management or evaluation. We just funded a project to train artists and arts organizations that want to work better with older populations. Obviously, as our state ages, there are a great many people who care about the arts and want to stay involved in them, but the way they will do that will change. And so we were able to offer this training program. And we and the regional arts councils all do as much as we can to promote our grantees, promote the activities that they are providing, and connect people to activities that they might enjoy being involved in. Very quickly, a summary of our funding. 99.6% of our funding comes from the state of Minnesota. Obviously, we are a state agency. Here's a slide of our general fund appropriations. 2002, 2003 was our high water mark. We were at about $25 million for that biennium. You'll see in the current biennium, we are at approximately $15 million in the general fund.
That's a big drop.
If you add in the legacy funds, the Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund dollars, you see that we were very honored to receive one of the larger appropriations from that fund for the first two cycles. Basically, what it did is it tripled our budget, and it tripled what we were able to do. So we went from approximately $10 million a year to approximately $30 million a year. So you ask, what are we doing with those dollars? This slide is just a snapshot of how it basically follows the way dollars are appropriated to us and how we are investing them. The general fund dollars are divided between grants and then operations and services, basically programs, professional development, those sorts of things fall into operations and services. Out of the legacy funds, our appropriation lines follow the language in the Constitution. So it talks about investing in arts and arts access, talks about investing in arts education and arts and cultural heritage. So that's an accounting for the roughly $60 million for this biennium. This talks a little bit about demand. In 2012, we're still in 13, so I don't have those numbers, but for last year, we as a system, the 12 of us, reviewed about 4,000 grant applications. We awarded 2,100 grants, totaling almost $27 million. In comparison, in 2009, the last year before the legacy funds were available, the total applications was 1,900, so requests have doubled, the number of grants have doubled, the dollars requested have grown fourfold. There are so many ideas, there are so many projects, there are so many activities out there that we just see the requests ballooning, and it's not inflation, it's not artificial, it's just that there are so many great ideas and so many new ways that we and regional arts councils can fund the arts in the state. This slide shows you I pulled out just a couple of examples of some of the kinds of grant programs that our friends at the regional arts councils are providing, the kinds of support that might be available if you were looking to your regional arts council. Support for arts and arts activities and artists is universal. We all do some flavor of that. One of our regional arts councils provides funding so that an organization that needs to do some ADA access work could do that. Maybe it's a ramp, maybe it's hiring somebody to do signed performances of a theater production. And some of the regional arts councils offer what they call legacy designation grants. They give money to a city government or a county government that can be used to integrate the arts into that city or county planning, make the arts more integral to the life of that community or that region. We see a lot of student mentorship programs at the regional level, student scholarships, a high school student or a college student who wants to work with a professional artist and improve their skills. We also see quite a bit of artist residency work where an artist goes into a school and works one-on-one for a few days. Some of the regional arts councils are funding public art, commissioning an artist to create a statue or a mural or other kind of work of art. And I realize that I just repeated the name at the bottom, but in some of the regions, there are what I'd call collaborative grant programs where an arts organization, a history organization, and maybe something connected to a cultural group or an ethnic group would get together on a collaborative project. And it's meant to build relationships and start those organizations working together. So I thought these were some of the really interesting programs at the regional level. This is the list of our programs, and I always have to say we're not very clever about naming our grant programs. So the names, I hope, tell you pretty much what they do. We have a touring program that sends artists from Duluth to Rochester and Moorhead artists to Worthington, moves arts activities all around the state. Arts Access is about serving underserved populations, whether that's a geographic population, whether it's age, whether it's economics. It's a way to try to break down barriers in a meaningful way. Partners in Arts Participation is a way for social service organizations to start integrating the arts into their programming. Arts learning is lifelong learning in the arts. Whether you're 3 or 93 and you want to learn to play the violin or take an arts class, we have ways to support that work. And then folk and traditional arts and festivals are the last of our programs. So you see in the left-hand column the general fund. This is what we have traditionally been doing. And a lot of what happened there is what we would think of as traditional arts activities in concert halls and in museums and those sorts of places, which is very, very important. And we continue to do that now. But what the legacy funds have allowed us to do is to really kind of throw the doors open, we and the regional arts councils. So, you know, in this first column, we're funding things like the Guthrie Theater and the Minneapolis Institute of Arts and those organizations that we all know and recognize. But when you move into the other column, we're also funding YMCAs and Boys and Girls Clubs and Senior Centers and the Epilepsy Foundation of Minnesota and others, trying to make the arts stronger wherever they might be and wherever Minnesotans might want them to be. And the last slide I'm giving you, these just happen to be two comments that passed my desk in the last few days. If it had been last week, it would have been two different comments. But they do summarize two of the key things that are happening because of the funding that we provide. One is quality of life. It makes a difference. A destination, a community that's stronger, a community that's more vibrant because of the funding. And the bottom one is from an organization that works with children with autism who would not fare well in a traditional kind of theater education program, but had opportunities to learn and to, as it says, develop new behaviors, make new friendships, and feel a sense of accomplishment that they wouldn't in a traditional sort of program. So the beauty of the funding we provide is it does both. It does the traditional kinds of things, and it tries to reach out and do things that are a little bit out of the ordinary. And here you have our website, and also on our website is a page that allows you to connect better to the regional arts councils and find out more about what they do. So that's our quick overview.
And Ms. Jens, we often get letters from recipients of arts grants with similar quotes like that as to what the grant is meant for them and their community. And I think that's really fun to find out. For those of you who are new, you might not have seen that yet, but it's really a good plan, very good idea. It's very personal, and oftentimes we get invited to participate in the event or activity, mm-hmm. and that's a good way, too, to learn about how the arts money and the legacy money is being used in our districts. So any questions? Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And we'll have, there'll be six members are up for confirmation from the Arts Board, and we'll have five of them there, I think, on Monday.
Madam Chair, I believe we'll have three with
us. Three will be with us.
Yes.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.